The story of Foundation, a concept imagined towards lifelong and transversal learning, has created and produced festivals in collaboration with scientists, artists, designers, philosophers, students, anthropologists, engineers, and educators towards the formation of a tribe and kinship that transverses borders and invites individuals to recognize knowledge. Knowledge that is produced and disseminated for the self and the community they inhabit. Keeping with the intention of this year's theme for the Transmission in Motion seminar, Expanded Practices of Knowing, Interdisciplinary Approaches, I now invite Jaya Ramchandani, researcher, curator, and director of the Storia Foundation, to understand the textures of kinship that emerge and how it implicates the kind of knowledge we produce and for whom. Hi, Jaya. Can you hear me?
Hi, Aishwarya. I can hear you really well.
Thanks for being here today. I'm excited to have this conversation with you. And if you're ready, I think, could you tell us a bit about your explorations in the field of learning and knowing practices, especially since you've moved between India, Netherlands, and now in Japan?
I was working in an academic editing company. And in 2009, I decided to quit my job because I realized I wasn't very well suited to a corporate way of functioning. And I thought I should get into the world of education. At that time, this was 2009, so multimedia and learning was becoming quite big. And I applied to 5 different degrees. 4 of them had to do with education and multimedia, and this one in astronomy and science-based business at Leiden University. I was lucky enough to get in everywhere. So then I had to choose, and I chose astronomy because I figured I can work in education and figure it out. But if I want to know about the universe, I need more support, and I need more teachers, and I need more mentors. And also, I thought it may be a good idea that before I start working in education, I relive the experience of being a student. It was amazing, life-changing, learning everything about the universe really puts you, it's like that pale blue dot stuff where you just understand your own insignificance, but you live it for a bit. And I spent, as the science-based business part of my program, I did an internship in an office called Universe Awareness, which did outreach to 4 to 10-year-old kids about the universe. And in that, I worked on the production of a box called Universe in a Box, which was a toolkit with only inquiry-based activities on how seasons happen, what is a constellation. It also had a lot of like cultural perspectives in it. For example, how different cultures view every constellation. And I really, really enjoyed being in that world of science outreach and interacting with students and kids and making events and just different formats of reaching astronomy to regular people. I decided not to stay in the Netherlands because I was missing home, and I came back to India. I'm from Mumbai, which is a city, and I didn't want to go back into the city because I felt kind of done with cities. So I shifted straight to Goa. And I spent a lot of time with a very close designer friend whose dad is an artist, and we were just kind of like immersed in this really beautiful nature house with clay and pottery all around us. And one day about like 6 of us were living in the house and decided to turn the house into a digestive system. So we you have these long steps coming down into a front room. So we made like an esophagus out of these bottles, put posters around. Then the first room was the stomach. We made it like we put all red lights, and our friends dressed up as enzymes. And we titled the concept, "Where's My Pow Gone?" So where's the bread? And at the top of the stairs, you started basically, we gave everybody a piece of bread that they sent down the esophagus into the stomach where the enzymes dissolved it in Coca-Cola, and then we sent them to the next room where out of tarpaulin we made like these pipes, so they go through the intestines and then they end up at the bathroom, which was the real bathroom. And if we followed it up with a like a tea tasting session, because another friend is a tea sommelier, so she organized this tea tasting session and we invited everybody from the local community. So about 40 people came by through our intestine and we just had a real riot doing it. From there kind of was birthed the idea of doing something on light or similar concepts starting in the house. In the meantime, I also organized a science meets nature camp. And that was also a lot of fun. We got kids from Thane in Mumbai to like a remote setting in Maharashtra, and where they interacted both with the people who owned the area. They brought in the perspective of nature and nature-based activities of building something with mud. And we brought in the science-based activities of like, say, launching a rocket or making a scribble machine. And so there was all these informal learning experiences with science and learning that were just happening unintentionally or intentionally. What it was kind of this interdisciplinary pursuit. That word comes up a lot in our work. And at the time when I went to the Netherlands, I also lost my father. So I was kind of like in this position for 2 years of a lot of death contemplation. So contemplating death, for which I would get into a lot of, I got very interested in Buddhist philosophy and Hindu philosophy. And studying about the universe. So I would say it was more the meeting of these two that really drove this quest to say, hey, why are these worlds not talking to each other more? Or even I'd say experiences like I'd read a story kind of like, so the center of our galaxy, so our galaxy is the Milky Way, and there's a black hole somewhere around the center of our galaxy. And the center of our galaxy, if you look up at the night sky, is in a constellation Sagittarius A. And then I read this story in some, like when I was just reading about how Yama, the god of death, because I was doing all this death reading and death contemplation, also lives in the same part of the sky where Sagi is. So I was like, yeah, nice coincidence, right? Like the god of death is the black hole. And that's the same position. And then I was asked like my professors, okay, so how come, like where do scientists go into these cosmological stories to get clues to further the science? And the advice from one like pretty senior scientist was like, you know, if you're interested in this kind of stuff, it's better, like I recommend you first do a PhD in astronomy and then go down that track rather than the other way around. So it was also a bit of this story has also this identity aspect of like my identity as an Indian and where does that fit in this world of research and discovery in a scientific manner. So there's the identity piece. There is the, oh, science communication is so much fun when artists and designers are involved because they just have a better language to explain the abstract. As well as this this reasoning, you know, like science brings some amount of like reasoning into the dialogue of what is what. So how do you have conversation around all these three things together? We brought those ideas home in the form of a festival that we called the Story of Light. And from there, a whole new kind of like chapter opened up into what all you can do in the foray of learning in different informal formats that is not a lecture and not a classroom.
Just going back to the part where you mentioned that you were interested in looking at how you could communicate and disseminate the concepts of astronomy with students in more informal capacities, I was curious to know how that has played out in your philosophy of learning. What kind of new communities do you see getting built through this kind of work?
The community that we attracted in the Story of Light was really interesting because this was essentially the first time anything like this was happening in India. And we just randomly like made a bunch of PPTs and put it out on the internet. And a lot of people wrote in from universities the world over to participate, as well as just random artist groups. And we also contacted two design institutes in India, the National Institute of Design and Srishti, which is your alumni, inviting students to come and be volunteers. And it was also a volunteer-run festival. So there's no one is doing anything here for the money. We are like kind of working together for 3 months in quite an intensive way, but just for the love of creating and talking about science and art and philosophy together on one platform. And it was very, very alive. That's one kind of like way I would describe the community that came together. And of course, a lot of us, because it's volunteer run, then we go back into our normal lives. And a lot of the participants became the team of the next festival, The Story of Space. So the need to have the dialogue was pretty apparent, which is why so many people would volunteer their time in the first place. And I'd say it was a community of just very passionate or eclectic people bringing who like to communicate and reach out.
How much of the site of the space that you were staying at in Goa, how much did that contribute to the kind of work that the festival does as of today? Is that as critical to your work, or was it coincidental that the site and the concept worked really well?
So when I first entered started interacting with artists, of course, we made a lot of fun of site specific because that came up 1,000 times. But I don't think the festival would have manifested the way it did at any other place. So remember the part of the story where I said we converted my friend's house into a digestive system and then we wanted to do something similar for light? Mm-hmm. What happened from there was when we put the call out, we started talking to different people, and Mr. Madhavan, he suggested to us that, hey, why don't you, if you want to do this kind of public communication, why don't you, the house is quite inside, like you can't reach it by public transport. So why don't you, if you want to make this public, why don't you take it out to the city and make it public? Mm-hmm. And that's when it really became, it went from being something that would be small in a neighborhood to being a public festival in a city. And Goa is, so one thing that happened when I went to the Netherlands, I noticed that the relationship between people and the government was very different from my relationship between me and my government back in India. I basically don't acknowledge my government in India. While their system was more established in terms of their tax-paying system and their social system, and their rules were more reasoned. So people kind of knew the reason for a particular law and would follow it. While here, it really depends on who you are and how you follow laws. Goa is actually, I don't know whether it currently holds the status, but it's the state in India with actually the highest GDP, at least back then. And it's a very small state, and the population will be, I think the population of Goa is less than Mumbai. So the population of a whole state is less than my city. The population of the capital is maybe somewhere around 200,000 people, as opposed to the population of Mumbai, which is something like 21 million people. And this all gives the condition where the government is actually approachable. You can go knock on someone's office and say, hi, I would like a meeting. And you don't have to be waiting for 23 days. So through some connections of friends, we had a meeting with the commissioner of the corporation of Panjim. And he really liked the idea of this science meets art concept as something that is relevant and valuable for Goa. And I would say it was our team members who were Goan, working with the government, who opened all the doors of getting all the sites, like the public beach or this the Entertainment Society of Goa building, to really allow us to have the spaces that would attract the projects that it did. So I can imagine maybe something like this happening in smaller places in the same kind of way. And I can't imagine it happening in bigger places, because there then the commercial angle becomes too big. While here there was no commercial angle, it was more the idea. The idea was sold.
Mm-hmm. Do you also see the festival then transforming what, like, the histories of these spaces would have been otherwise without the festival occurring there?
So actually, both the spaces. So there was the hospital was actually in town, which was not the one used for the immersive theater. That was then the Entertainment Society of Goa building. After we first used it in 2015, another big arts organization also started using it as a site for their festival. And the exact same thing happened with the space that you were referring to, which was the old Goa Institute of Management. And only a part of the building was still being used for classes, and the other part of the building was completely vacant, which is what we took over to make the Evolution of the Stars, which was this amazing immersive 17-room multi-extravaganza experience. I don't know how to describe it. And that site too now is also being used for another festival, and I think it's going to be taken over by one of the cultural departments and now developed further. So I would like to give the whole story of a big pat on the back to reopen these spaces as public spaces rather than leave them vacant, and I guess in a way make a new history around them and use the space.
I can imagine it being quite an experience to do that and to see the transformation. Considering how important physical site has been to the festival, yeah. I sort of wanted to move to where we are at today and with the current lockdown and how things are either partially or completely shifting online. And I was wondering how you see this transition affect, whether positively or negatively, the practice of learning.
So we are a bit in a pickle around this one, because so our third festival is coming up. The third theme is mind. The first theme was light. The second theme was space. And the third theme is mind. And the festival series was kind of envisioned in a trilogy, and then you stop and then you do something else. At the same time, because we've been volunteer run, we know that this can't go on for too long, because at some point you run out of energy, right? And the people who kind of like the new generation who would hopefully take it over has to be doing it with the same amount of energy for that volunteer run system to work. Mm. So we've been talking over the last 2 years of like pivoting the story off into kind of a social business around lifelong learning. And in that, we've been imagining like more of a hybrid blended format of where you have some online events, where you have some offline events, and they kind of like work together and feed into each other to make more learning journeys for people. So because the history of that is when we started communicating about ourselves, we started communicating as an interdisciplinary informal learning initiative. But nobody really understood these words. It would just go in the box of, we don't understand what you're talking about. You must be some elite, stupid person. When we started talking about the story of Mind Festival for in COVID times, the original date was supposed to be Jan 2021, which now looks pretty bleak. Then we thought, oh, now everybody's online. Maybe we will do an online festival. In principle, we all agreed to the idea. So, like, say the core team is now about 6 people, and in principle, we were like, yeah, it's a good idea. Everyone's online right now. Let's see what innovation can happen there. But in reality, our physical bodies were not making any action towards it. Then we started exploring a lot of like really cool examples of what people are doing online. So I think you know how when you're going for a workshop, a physical workshop, there's always this networking thing that's happening before, after, during those physical connections you're making. In all the online events that I have been attending, that networking connection is missing. So I think that's something that this that's an area of innovation in the online world to make a learning event more successful. This non-verbal communication part or this relationship building part that you're not planning for it, you're not forcing for it, but that is actually more than 50% of the experience. How does that get in is something that we are thinking about, to think of taking a festival online in a not so transactional fashion. And other than that, I think there are some other initiatives that we've started, like short courses in a live online learning format, or learning mediation or coaching in an online format that I think has very, very good potential to bring a whole learning ecosystem together. So there are different parts that make a good learning experience or a useful learning experience. So what is the right balance between online and offline? We don't know yet, but we would like both inside. I don't think only, first of all, offline is such a strange word, don't you think? It's like online is now the main thing and offline seems to be secondary, but I don't know, there's no other terminology. Face to face, I don't know. But how to keep that human physical connection in play?
Before we close, I just wanted to understand a part of your practice which you've mentioned earlier. You said that you're also looking at learning practices as new forms of citizenship, how you imagine sociocracy as an ideology and philosophy play into practices of learning.
Schools are big babysitting organizations so the workers can work. And essentially, speaking from a place of privilege, I can recognize that the only reason why I think a lot about social issues is because I have time to think about social issues. And if I look at people who have time, for example, all the philosophers, all the scientists making really strange discoveries, they have all come from a place of privilege and have had time. So one question to ask is that if you have time to do and think whatever you want, do you naturally gravitate to thinking about the well-being of others as well? I would like to argue maybe, because that's something I observe. back to the original question of sociocracy. I was looking for a governance system, and it's essentially a governance structure that helps you shift the power away from the top and spread it within the organization. So one of the key aspects of sociocracy is this consent-based decision making. And the principle there is good enough for now, safe enough to try. So basically you create these circles, and all these circles are, there is still a power structure, but it's a power structure where you are more aware of your power in a way. And also you have to roll out your decisions through a group where people have a chance to object to them. And you can make a reasoned objection and then seek consensus within that group. How does this connect to learning? A part of my research is around learner agency. And what this basically talks about, agency is the power to act. So essentially what we've gone and done is we have removed agency from people in schools by always expecting them to listen to what we say as an adult and planning their education for them. We are the planners, they are the doers. We are the directors, they are the followers. Yeah, as adults. And there is this whole movement in like of self-directed learning schools and schools that are like promoting, or individuals that are promoting learner agency, where there is a movement to shift a part of that power back to the students. Mm-hmm. So away from the administration, and like kind of like dilute the say. Maybe the government has some part of the say, the parents have some part of the say, the administration has some part of the say, and the faculty has some part of the say, and the students have some part of the say. More kind of like that kind of a framework-based system where multiple people are pitching into what should be learnt, rather than the system of, I know better, you are going to do what I tell you to do. Mm-hmm. So sociocracy is a way for that to play out, for everyone to be heard. Because we are not used to structures where we hear everybody. We are used to structures where there are some people that are regarded as more powerful and more influential and who say matters more. Mm-hmm. And sociocracy is a way for that to start being dismantled.
Definitely in our current times, it's interesting to see this kind of process and work that's being practiced by individuals such as Jaya and the Storia Foundation that is dismantling continuously traditional hierarchies. And we look forward to the kind of work that Storia plans on doing. But that's it for today. Thank you for your time, and see you next time.